today's Los Angeles Times, actually, about the LAPD. And continuing with that story. But Superior Court Judge Jacqueline Connor late Friday took the highly unusual step of overruling the jury after concluding that the panel had been confused about some of the evidence before it. Her decision could set up an appeal or a retrial of the three officers who were convicted of conspiracy and perjury in fabricating charges against gang members. In the interview with the Times, Park said LAPD investigators would meet in the coming days with officials from the DA's office to consider whether the case would be best pursued by appealing Friday's ruling or by merely refiling the case and trying it again in front of a new jury. That decision, Park stressed, would be made by prosecutors, but police would be prepared to support the prosecution in either event. Another possibility raised by law enforcement sources close to the Rampart investigation is that the case be taken over by the U.S. Attorney's Office as part of a federal civil rights prosecution. Sandy Gibbons, spokeswoman for the newly elected District Attorney Steve Cooley, said prosecutors would study Connor's ruling over the next few weeks before deciding how best to respond. Cooley was vacationing in Hawaii and was not immediately available for comment. In her ruling, Connor tossed out the jury verdicts against Sergeants Edward Ortiz and Brian Lydian Officer Michael Buchanan. The three were found guilty November 15th of conspiring to obstruct justice by fabricating evidence and framing gang members whom they accused of trying to run them down with a pickup truck. Prosecution argued that the assault had never occurred. The judge concluded the jurors had considered irrelevant and incorrect evidence, testimony that the officers had been victims of assault with great bodily injury in reaching their decisions. In fact, Connor said that that term was cop speak for assault with force likely to produce great bodily injury, a far different concept since it does not require anyone to have actually been injured. She said that some jurors apparently voted to convict the officers because they saw no evidence that the officers had been seriously injured and therefore believed that they must have been lying. She also admitted to having made a fatal error herself by denying a jury request to hear a rereading of testimony about great bodily injury. At the time, she said she thought the issue was irrelevant. She realized only later that it was crucial. Connor did not agree with one defense argument, however, that the jury foreman had tainted the case by expressing bias against the officers. She said she found the allegations troubling, but not solid enough to overturn the verdict. Connor said she could not let the public's desire to root out corruption dissuade her from making the right legal decision in the case, while recognizing the enormous pressure on the community, on the police force, on the district attorney's office, and on the courts to fix the Rampart scandal. This court is only interested in covering it up, in evaluating the fairness of the proceedings in this court and determining whether justice was done in this case, Connor wrote. The judge's 18-page decision was a potentially crushing setback for police and prosecutors investigating the LAPD corruption scandal. It comes at a time when prosecutors both in the DA's office and the U.S. Attorney's office are gearing up to file possible corruption charges against other LAPD officers. For the officers in the case before Connor, however, the ruling was a relief and a vindication. I am certainly pleased the way the judge analyzed the verdict in this case, said attorney Barry Levin, who represented Ortiz. The prosecution was not based on evidence. It was a political prosecution. Levin's remarks were echoed by the other lawyers for the defendants, even as Connor's ruling drew mixed reviews in some legal and police circles. Winston Kevin McKesson, who represents Rafael Perez, the corrupt former officer who launched the scandal, said there is one thing Connor's ruling will not change. The conscience of the community, the jury, has spoken in this case, and no amount of post-trial legal technicalities can unring that bell that the jury rang on the day that they rendered their verdict, McKesson said. State Senator Tom Hayden, Democrat of Los Angeles, a longtime police reform activist, called Connor's ruling an embarrassing decision with frightening ramifications. This is not the first time Connor's objectivity has come under question. Before the trial even began, Connor came in for criticism after it was disclosed that before being assigned the Rampart case, she had publicly stated she did not want to see Perez, the former officer at the center of the scandal, in her courtroom. The statement, which she said she made in jest, came 3 years after she wrote a glowing commendation calling then-Officer Perez an example of the best that law enforcement offers its community. Connor also issued a series of rulings that many legal observers interpreted as favorable to the defense. Among her critics was attorney Stephen Yagman, who has often criticized local judges for their handling of police abuse cases. I'm certainly not surprised to learn that a judge who appeared to be bending over backward in favor of the defense would overturn these verdicts when simply tipping the scale in their favor didn't adequately bamboozle the jury, said Yagman, who has made a career of suing the LAPD over alleged civil rights violations. Others took the opposite view. Bill Secchi, a former prosecutor in the DA's Special Investigations Division who has since joined the defense bar, praised the judge's decision. I think it takes a lot of courage for her to do something that is going to be extremely unpopular with those who didn't sit through the trial and who don't know the facts that were presented at the trial, Secchi said. From what I know of what she was presented, she did the right thing. Secchi is one of two lawyers representing Perez's former partner, Nino Durden, who is charged with attempted murder and is expected to stand trial next year. That is to say, he's one of the LAPD dirty cops, or accused dirty cops. Perez never took the stand on the trial that concluded in November. During much of it, he was dogged by the allegations of a former lover that he had killed a drug dealer and buried the body in Tijuana. The alleged crime, which Perez denied, could have been used in an attempt to impeach him if he had been called as a witness. The woman who accused him of that has since recanted her allegations and pleaded guilty to making false statements to authorities. Secchi said that could revive Perez as a witness, not only against Durden, but in a new trial for the first three officers as well. On Saturday, Chief Parks declined to comment on the likelihood of Perez's testifying, saying that, too, is a decision for prosecutors. We've said all along that Perez has to be corroborated by physical evidence, the chief said. That's true in this case. The prosecution did an excellent job with the case in this trial, and they'll be even better prepared next time. In her ruling, Connor criticized the prosecution for waiting until the end of the trial to announce that it wouldn't be calling Perez as a witness, a decision that forced the defense to waste time preparing for a non-existent star witness. She also criticized the news media for what she described as inaccurate reporting that might have tainted the case. The judge's ruling created a little noticeable stir in the central Los Angeles neighborhoods served by the Rampart Police Division. At the heart of the district, the streets around MacArthur Park were filled with familiar sights, sounds, and smells. Shoppers on the sidewalk Saturday evening, street vendors cooking hot dogs, storefront stereos blasting music in Spanish and English. There was little sense that the judge's ruling would have an effect on people's lives. It's too bad, but it won't make a difference, said Afsana Abian, the owner of the Big $5 Fashion on West 7th Street. Police, he said, don't care about this area. There's so much prostitution and drugs and people offering to sell you fake Social Security cards, driver's licenses, but they don't do anything about it. In a news conference at his Brentwood office, defense attorney Levin said the case from the beginning wasn't evaluated on the strength of public pressure. There was a marked lack of physical evidence. I am thankful that we have a system of checks and balances so that when there is a mistake, it can be rectified, he said. He said Ortiz was extremely pleased that the court set aside the verdict. My client has been through a lot. My client is relieved. And that's the story from the LA Times as the first ever convictions against LA police officers for fabricating evidence was tossed out by what appeared to be a judge friendly to the police department defendants. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert. Call-in number is 427-3772.
The president signed the GATT treaty into law. Fast-acted Congress with only hours of debate. We ceded our authority in the blink of an eye to a group of corporations that have purchased the right. They call it free trade. I'll tell you what that means. You can have your unions here, but the factories overseas, putting poisons in the water, paid pennies, were being sold down the river. The WTO sold down the river, sold down the river, sold down the river. The WTO. The plan the next century, and we need to be there in the streets when the size of corporations exceeds the finances of nations. Democratic process cannot compete. They call it free trade. I'll tell you what that means. Your health and safety laws, democratically made, can be challenged from abroad as barriers to foreign trade. We're being sold down the river. WTO, sold down the river, sold down the river, sold down the river. WTO, sold down the river, sold down the river, sold down the river. WTO.
it's time to have a slave rebellion, folks. Let's not get sold down the river. Let's stand up on issues of rent control, police misconduct, basic civil rights on the streets, wherever your rights are trampled. Let others know what's going on, because you're probably not the only one it's happening to. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert. This is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides and Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. You can call in at 427-3772. Don't be shy. If you're a first-term caller, we got time for you, or a first-time caller, rather. Please join us. We can use your thoughts and your input. The last city council meeting of the year, some would say of the millennium, if you consider 2000 to be really the last year of the second millennium, happened on December 12th. And the recording that I was able to get of the council meeting was very bad, mainly because I was not allowed to place my microphone at the podium where I have been allowed for the last 12 years to place my mic. Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice decided that would not be decorous, that would not be in keeping with the proper decorum of the city council. So I was told I had to plug it in over to the side, and unfortunately the plugs were not working very well, and we don't have a good recording. So I'm left with the position of either trying to dub a tape from the library, and you can hear city council proceedings in the library at the right across from city council offices if you're interested. They let you borrow a tape recorder to go down there. So if you have any perverse interest in what the city council has to say or what people going to city council had to say, you can find it out there. Because I couldn't do this decent tape recording, I can't play you rather interesting series of statements by people from the apartments in the Beach Flats, the Rodriguez apartments. And you also can't hear Fitzmaurice cutting me off as I attempt to go to the mic and speak as the last speaker. But what I do have for you are some interviews from some folks who are concerned about medical marijuana. One of them, a woman who is an attorney in a wheelchair. We've talked a lot about the double-crossing of the Cannabis Pharmaceuticals Club, which essentially died about a month and a half ago, and because Mayor Fitzmaurice and the mayor before him, Keith Sugar, were unwilling to do what San Francisco and Oakland did, which is put on the agenda a call for a medical marijuana emergency. They wouldn't even return calls to medical marijuana worker Kate Wells. Apparently, some people said it was favoritism toward WAM, one of the small groups in town. Some said they just didn't like Kate Wells because she took civil rights cases against the city and against the police department, particularly in cases like Steve Argue and Officer Dave LaFavre or David Silva and the police department, and when he was dragged away under the 5150 hold this summer, dragged away from city council in what clearly seemed rather thinly disguised political act by Mayor Sugar to get rid of him from the discourse. Anyway, I did get some tape, however, as I said, of this medical marijuana discussion outside, and I'm going to play that for you now.
After I have been, should we say, denied oral communication, but let's not talk about that. I mean, hey, me. And we're talking to, actually, an attorney.
Yes, my name is Pamela Smith. I'm an attorney in San Jose. I'm concerned because the marijuana clinic that I had joined in order to get medicine for my disability has closed. And I think one of the reasons they've closed is because the city council is treating medical marijuana clinics as if they were large pharmacies, which they're not. They're volunteer organizations. The law says they're not allowed to make a profit, and yet they're requiring things like a certified public accountant to certify their business at the end of the year. Well, even the Small Business Administration for minority businesses does not require a certified public accountant until you're over $200 million in businesses, because they know very well that it is an extremely expensive thing to have done. If you look at the accounting that they're requiring, they're requiring the same accounting that San Jose required when they indicted that poor
Peter Baez.
for a felony, and the felony that they indicted him for was not being able to show receipts of all of his purchases. Well, I have news for you. Marijuana is still illegal, and you can't grow enough to provide the patients with enough stuff, so you have to go on the black market to provide the marijuana, and people aren't going to give names and receipts for selling illegal substances. Growing it is still a felony in the state of California, unless you can prove that you're growing it for a marijuana clinic, and even then... The feds will come after you, so it's got to be done sub rosa, and it doesn't seem to me that the city council is addressing these issues, and in fact, the regulations are so appalling, I just can't believe that they came out of the city of Santa Cruz, because I really like this city. It's one of, I like the way it's run, I like the way that there's recycling on the streets, I like the shops, I like the ocean. I think that this city is a gorgeous, beautiful city, known for its care of all of its citizens, and it's just appalling that they're treating the people who need medical marijuana in this fashion.
Well, I know that it's a big regulation. I went and got the papers. I said I'd like to look at the medical marijuana law and the application process, and I was handed like a 40-50-page document to look at, which I didn't look at very carefully, but you have examined that document?
I have examined it just today, and I walk through spots of it. For one thing, you have to account for every, you have to count for all the marijuana sales on a daily basis, both in the morning and at night. Now, no business does this. You have to have security night and day over all of your supplies. Now, that makes sense, but also over all your gardens. So if somebody has a little plant of marijuana to grow for themselves and they got a permit to do this, they have to have day and night security, which calls the cops immediately if the security is broken. I mean, this is insane. So what they're doing is they are using the old catch-22 to stop this from happening. And it just does not seem the way the city of Santa Cruz normally runs. On the other hand, I have great sympathy for the people who are working with an entirely new issue, trying to make it happen correctly. I just think they have gone overboard by putting absolutely everything in there and ignoring the things that are really important, such as these guys are volunteers. Because of the nature of the transactions, everything happens in cash. The cash is there. They do their best to provide security and to make it as careful as possible, at least the clinic that died did, to make it as careful as possible and as safe as possible for the patients to buy it. But even so, they must have thousands of dollars of cash and pharmaceuticals on hand at all times. That's a very dangerous situation for the volunteers. None of that has been addressed by these people. It really seems to me that by looking at it as if we are going to make it as strict as we possibly can, what they're doing is saying, absolutely no, we don't want this in the city. Marijuana was easier to purchase in the city of Santa Cruz before it became illegal before it was legalized by the state. When it was illegal in the state, Santa Cruz turned a blind eye to this happening, and I was able to purchase medicine for my friend who was dying of cancer with no problem at all. Then it became legal, and everybody and their dog got in there and started writing regulations, and it just became impossible for any volunteer nonprofit organization to meet the criteria of these regulations. Get a copy yourself there at the city manager's office.
With us also is Scott Graham, who's a regular council watcher. Scott, you've observed this process of the council's passing medical marijuana regulations. You've observed attorney and cannabis pharmaceuticals collective worker Kate Wells come repeatedly to city council asking for them to decriminalize or to facilitate her use permit process. You have any thoughts on what you've just heard here?
Well, originally it seemed like the original plan was going to sail through without a bunch of clauses. Like she was mentioning that they have all these rules and regulations on the actual functioning of the clubs. And then it seemed that once you yourself became an advocate for this, and Kate Wells, another person that's disdained by the council, that all of a sudden it became necessary for them to pile on all these regulations to kind of push you two into a corner.
So you see this as sort of a peculiar ad hominem attack on two individuals?
I mean, yes,
to penalize hundreds of medical marijuana patients?
Right. I see this as a personal attack on you and Kate by the council, which affects women like her and her friends and other people around the community that rely on a continuous supply of medical marijuana.
Well, I think that if Kate had said nothing and I had said nothing, they would still have had the problem of not having a use permit.
The problem with the use permit seems to be that they rented the place, they thought that it was okay, it turned out that there was a home school for five or six kids that was three or four doors down. They didn't understand that that was there, there was no way that they could know that it was there, and they had signed a lease. So it looks like they had to disband the organization in order to get out of the lease. There is probably no school there, but they say that there's a school there, so let's just take the fact that there's a school, a home school for five or six kids there, three or four doors down, but even so, they would not necessarily have known that that was true when they signed the lease.
In fact, they were assured by city officials that there was no school there.
There is no home school. What it is Barrios Unidos has a plan to open up a charter school. It is not open, it is not functioning, they have no credentials. They did, however, get $1 million from the city of Santa Cruz to do this, but they have not started the school yet. And like I said earlier, this did not become an issue. They had written a law that was clearly to the benefit of the medical marijuana user. Once Kate Wells and Robert Norris jumped on the bandwagon, suddenly they had to make this law something onerous. And that's exactly what happened.
The law is extremely onerous. On the other hand, to give a little point to the city council, if somebody has gotten, it looks like there was a lack of communication since somebody got money and was planning to build a school next door. If I had been doing the negotiation of the lease, I would have made getting the use permit part of the lease, and if the use permit was not to be issued, cancel the lease. So I believe that the medical marijuana clinic also made a tactical and legal error in their negotiation of the lease. However, that does not take away from the fact that these, I guess I would call them draconian regulations. I ran a consulting business in Berkeley, so I know a lot about use permits and how businesses work and how the Small Business Administration works, and I find these regulations appalling, frankly.
Well, see, one of the problems is prior, when the Santa Cruz Pharmaceuticals leased this building, there was nothing in this law about a use permit. It was after the fact that the law was changed to include a use permit. So they didn't err. The city council actually, after the fact, wrote in this clause for the use permit, the special use permit.
I hate to differ with you, but there's another problem with volunteer organizations and a business attorney looking at how volunteer organizations work. But as a business attorney, I would have had a clause in there saying if the business can't open, the lease doesn't exist, just out of sheer paranoia. But that aside, volunteer organizations are a special breed. It's very difficult for them to run. And what the city council has written the regulations for, they've written the regulations as if these were a up-and-running business selling legal drugs. And it's not an up-and-running business selling legal drugs. It is a struggling business selling drugs that are only semi-legal, and they have to make it easier for these volunteer organizations to provide what the patients need.
Any final words, point, counterpoint?
Well, I'm not trying to say anything against what she's saying. I'm just trying to clarify the issue.
I appreciate your clarification.
The issue is that the city has systematically tried to block Kate Wells and the organization that which she is linked with from being able to legally operate. And that's exactly what is going on here. It's not a matter of that the city council disagrees with what they are going to do. It's just that they have a problem with a person. There's a personality conflict here that has to do with Kate. And if there had been another attorney involved in this other than Kate, there probably wouldn't have been this problem. But because it was Kate, just like with you, Robert, you've seen the same thing happen over and over again because you're involved in things, all of a sudden the ears close and the backroom maneuvering starts.
Well, there is a way of dealing with city councils in a non-confrontational manner, which is to be recommended. On the other hand, since the patients don't show up because they're frightened of being identified because they're sick, and coming to a city council meeting is very difficult for them. In fact, I haven't been to a city council. This is the first city council meeting I have attended since I got disabled. That's how
you are in a wheelchair right now.
Yes, although I have a new knee and I have much more energy and I am walking more, I still use a wheelchair for distance moving. So, yes, it is very difficult for me to come. I saved energy for 2 weeks to make this.
Well, I know that I and I guess Scott as well, urged Kate to bring a lot of people down here, great numbers of patients, as many as she could, and sympathizers, to not just to confront the city council and say, look, we need you to smooth this process through, or we're just going to lose our club, and people will be sent back to the black market, or to San Francisco, which apparently where you're going to be forced to go. But also, to begin distribution here, if necessary, to actually do a distribution at City Hall. So if you will not provide us with a place, we'll begin distributing here in a public place, because we have no choice. In fact, they talked about distributing out of a trailer at some point, but that never happened. And I guess, I mean, I'm a person who immediately jumps often into situations of peaceful but high-profile civil disobedience in circumstances like this, where I feel there is real community support. And I'm surprised I didn't try that. And what's happened instead is people have just let this club, and or you weren't even told about it. The club just dissolved.
Well, actually, I guess it was too late after I volunteered to help them out. I guess what I would like to see happen would be a task force among the people who are using marijuana and are interested in trying to get these nonprofit organizations set up so that the regulations can be more written better, and so that the nonprofit organizations can actually meet the regulations, because I'm going to have to go back either to San Francisco or out on the street, and I'm not happy about it, because in a wheelchair situation, I know very well that I won't be able to do what I did before, which is just park in front and hop out. I will have to drive to San Francisco, which for me is a thing like tonight. I'll have to save the energy for 2 weeks, and that I'm trying to start my own law office. It's a very difficult choice to make on whether or not I should go get my medicine or whether I should just forget about it and go back to the stuff that I know is very bad for my body.
We're talking about what, medical marijuana of a less appropriate sort, or talking about different medication?
Well, even if I have a different medication, but even if I have to, if I have to go to San Francisco, that's a long haul for me. It's a very difficult choice.
You had something you wanted to say about this issue too. Your name again?
Yeah, my name is Gary Rogers, and I think that what I would like to see is the patients actually getting taken care of. I really don't care about the politics involved. The people that need the medicine that is better for them than all the stuff that they've been getting from the pharmaceuticals and the doctor's best efforts to provide them with medications that tear their bodies up in some cases. Some medications are really almost worse than what they're intended to help.
Are you a Santa Cruzan yourself?
Yeah, I was born in Santa Cruz.
And have you used the cannabis clubs here yourself?
Yes, we've been going to Santa Cruz Cannabis Pharmaceuticals for a few months, and we're considering not taking the pharmaceutical medications from the doctor under his supervision and making a transfer over to medical marijuana, which has absolutely no side effects.
What's your medical condition, and what medications are you transferring from?
Well, my wife is taking anti-seizure medications for epilepsy. It's been a lifelong condition.
And that's you?
Yeah, that's me.
Right.
And some of the side effects, the list is like 4 feet long. Every time we get a bottle of medication, the list of side effects is 4 feet long and tiny print. And it covers, I mean, everything from gum disease and loss of teeth and porphyria, you know, light, headaches, nausea, and all kinds of just long-lasting liver disease and kidney problems and a lot of other stuff I can't even understand. And some of it even involves cancer and cancer lumps and stuff. And we don't get these from marijuana. So what we'd like to do, but what the deal is, it takes a lot of marijuana, like 10 joints a day. And, you know, at that level, you don't get high anymore. You know, it's not a thing to get stoned. But it works on the back of the brain, and it does what these anti-seizure medications do. And it's just a whole lot better. It's not a lot cheaper. But you can't just quit. You have to do it under a doctor's supervision.
You can't quit the previous medication.
Right. You can't just drop off the pharmaceutical stuff. And
barbiturates, you can go into seizures. Yeah.
Barbiturates, mycelline, Dilantin, these things you have to build up a level. And to kind of wean yourself off of those with a doctor's supervision takes, you know, a couple months. And you can't just start them back up. You know, you go through the whole seizure problem and the whole readjustment. And so you need a stability. You know, you just can't have a place opening up, closing down, opening up, closing down. You know, you have to make a decision and stick with it for a long time. And it's expensive. You have to see the doctor. We don't have insurance. We have to pay the doctors, you know. And they're good. The doctors that we've been seeing are fine people. But we can't afford to make the switch and just, you know, keep up the constant supervision. So I'd like to see people actually have a cooperative of just the patients. And, you know, to hell with doctors and lawyers. Not all. And I would just like to see maybe some kind of a cooperative effort to, like, grow and distribute and have the stability. And so we could just kind of take care of ourselves naturally instead of making some pharmaceutical company rich.
I think that was the idea of these local clubs. What's your thoughts on this? You're the person who...
But I did want to say that my mother died of liver cancer, and I don't want to go the same way, so I'd rather go to the cannabis pharmacy. And I don't think it would mess my liver up so much.
Are you finding liver problems with medications for epilepsy that you're taking now?
Well, no, not yet.
But
I don't
expect that may happen?
I don't see why not. I mean...
It's on the list.
Yeah, it's on the list.
Well, I guess, you see, it's like everyone agrees that this is the good solution, and people get together, they form cooperatives, and then you have bureaucratic bodies that suddenly are standing in the way. And I'm just, to me, I mean, my reaction is to simply confront the bureaucratic body. And hopefully if you do so with enough people in a clear enough way over a long enough period of time, you get a positive result. The problem we had with, I can't think, the Cannabis Club is that, first of all, nobody ever organized a kind of a massive effort where 30 or 40 people came. There were several nights when Cannabis Club had a dozen people in the audience, and they asked, you know, couldn't you please do something? And council said, we'll look into it, you know, and they didn't. Or if they did, we don't know what they did. There's no report, there's no FYI that came back. And it seems, I mean, it's hard to tell. Scott Graham had the idea that this was some personal thing directed against Kate Wells, because she's engaging in lawsuits defending the rights of people who've been abused by police officers in the city, for example, and some people on the city council may not like that. But the idea that the council is so biased, so corrupt, or so insensitive to the basic needs of people that they would punish not just one person, but hundreds of people, to me, is really hard to believe. Anything you want to conclude with yourself over here? Or you?
Not me.
Okay.
I don't want to make any accusations about to the city council about why they did it. I think they tried to write a law that covered all contingencies, and they just overdid it. And they need to go back and look at it as if these were nonprofit organizations that need their help, rather than that these are people selling illegal substances and we have to stop them. I think they did. They really tried to do a good job, it looks like. They just overdid it.
Well, it's not that they didn't do a good job or did do a good job one way or the other on this particular law. It's that they refused to take the next step, which is to pass an ordinance like San Francisco did, which suspends the need for elaborate use permits during this period because there's a medical emergency. And they refused to even consider that.
That I can't answer. I don't have enough knowledge of the politics in Santa Cruz to comment on it at all.
I understand. Well, I want to thank you all, and again, we've been talking to
Pamela Smith,
Gary Rogers,
Martha Rogers.
Thank you very much, all of you, here for tonight. We're talking to
Father Philip Massetti.
And you are with
the Oblates of St. Joseph, the Shrine of St. Joseph on West Cliff Drive.
Now, you're the last item on tonight's evening agenda, the last agenda of the year. What are you here for?
We want to expand our parking lot. We want to provide adequate parking for the people who want to come to church at our place. And right now, we don't have enough space, so to be able to expand our seating, we need to have so many extra parking spaces.
So how many folks does your church accommodate right now?
Right now, it accommodates 200.
And your parking lot accommodates?
That 200, but we want to expand the seating to double that size.
Now where is your church?
We're right out on across from the statue of the surfer on West Cliff Drive.
Okay.
West Cliff Drive in Pelton.
Is this outside the city limits or inside?
Inside the city limits.
Yeah. Have you ever had, and you take homeless people in at night? Are you part of the ISSP program?
No. We have a school attached to the property. that it's a difficulty with to have homeless people come in, you know, to sleep there. So we're just cautious.
And of course, that's ridiculous because the homeless program would happen in the evenings and the early mornings before people were there at the school. Plus the fact that the idea that homeless people can't coexist with, in fact, be a very vital part of an education for young people is ridiculous. But rationalizations are many, and this apparently is one of them.
About the impact that would have with the school children around.
Have people in vehicles ever asked you if they could use your property at night to sleep and park on?
They have over the years.
One of the few exceptions to the sleeping ban in the city. Churches can't allow 3 vehicles per night to sleep there with their permission.
Is that it? Well, that's good. And we have, again, with that caution that by the time the school children, you know, arrive in the morning, that they're out of the parking lot.
How do prospects look for your expansion? And are there people just who don't want you to expand? What's the story?
There are just a few people who are opposing us, and they're opposing us on environmental reasons, primarily the monarch butterflies. But we've had investigations done and surveys done, and there's no real impact or harm that will be.
Let me ask you the loaded question. Earlier I handed you a petition asking you to sign ending the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. You're familiar with this controversy. You've been around for a while, I imagine.
Actually not. I've just been here for a couple of years, and I haven't really been paying attention. So I can't. That's why I didn't sign.
And one wonders what a man of the cloth would be doing as a church person if she or he didn't know about the law that criminalized homeless people at night. But then again, a lot of churches are not for the benefit of the poor, but for the benefit of the middle class and the fairly well-to-do. And at least one individual has characterized this church as a sort of a more conservative breakaway from the St. Francis, the Holy Cross Church, which has a somewhat more activist agenda. Father Marini at least showed up at a couple of the task force to examine the camping ordinance meetings, I think was involved in the progressive fast, and has been part of David Silva's, the initiative to end the sleeping ban and the fast to end the sleeping ban at different times.
I'd like to study it and see what kind of an effect that it does.
Issues
have.
Are
correct. Yeah.
Perhaps we should get back to you and get you some literature and get your thoughts later.
That'll be great.
Thanks again, and we'll see what happens tonight.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Yeah. I'm going to keep my mind open for this.
Your name, sir, is
Reverend Dr. William.
And you're here for the issue of the church parking lot expansion.
Right.
But you're also a man with some thoughts on the issue of the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, the law that prescribes a $54 penalty for anyone, be he high or low, who sleeps outdoors or in a vehicle anywhere on city property.
You want me to comment on that?
Yes.
How can somebody who's homeless afford to pay $54 or $55?
No, wait, I don't want to hear any bleeding heart talk about these lazy homeless hobos who are flocking to Santa Cruz by the thousands.
Well, the point I was trying to make was, isn't it kind of ridiculous or nonsensical to fine somebody who can't afford to pay the fine in the first place?
It tells them
is that a solution?
It tells them to move along. It gets them out of the area. We don't really want their kind around here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I understand that, but isn't the whole problem more deeply rooted than that?
Well,
I mean, fines and we got to go back to, and maybe you don't want to talk about that. What I would talk about is the money supply. You know, who's controlling the money? Who's got the money? There's all kinds of work out there. There always has been. But if you don't have money to pay for the work being done, then the work doesn't get done. You can't hire anybody.
Is this Father Coughlin's argument? I don't know. Are we going back to the mid-30s here? Social credit theory?
No.
Father Townsend's scheme?
I'm not even sure I've heard of him.
Although
it does ring a bell.
He's an old geezer, kind of pro-fascist, but that's another story.
Well, I'm an old geezer, too.
Me too, I gotta say. but what about getting back to the sleeping ban itself, the law that criminalizes homeless people at night? Should that law be lifted in the winter if there is no shelter for homeless people to speak of? There's 160 spaces in the Interface Satellite Shelter, but that's for 1,000 to 2,000 people. So, effectively, there's no shelter for most homeless people. They have to sleep in vehicles, under bushes, under bridges. Should they be criminalized for doing so, or should they, say, rather be criminalized for inappropriate behavior like urinating, defecating, Although one wonders how inappropriate that is when you don't have the facilities, but let's say grant you that that's inappropriate. Sleeping. Should sleeping itself be criminal? Your view.
Not in itself, but where it takes place.
These Norsian radicals who want to overturn everything that our society holds dear here?
I'm not siding with anyone. I'm just trying
not.
To... I don't think I can come up with a solution for it. It is a definite problem. It's a problem for them. It's a problem for a lot of people. How to solve it is a solution. Letting them use the armory up at Soquel, is that a permanent solution? No, I think it's a Band-Aid. Is giving them an accommodation somewhere around in downtown Santa Cruz, is that a solution? No, I think that's another Band-Aid. What is the solution? I don't know. I think it's rooted in our economy. Look at the price of housing in Santa Cruz.
While we're working on these grander solutions, what about the poor guys who are trying to sleep tonight? Shouldn't they get a little relief from this council that says, okay, you don't get criminalized for sleeping. For other bad behaviors, yes, but for sleeping, no.
But we go through this every winter.
We do.
So whatever is happening is a Band-Aid. It's not.
But they don't do it. They never decriminalize it. It's never been decriminalized. Not that that would be any solution in any broader sense to housing, but it would remove the added kick in the butt of an additional ticket.
Uh-huh. Well, decriminalization... You probably have a good point there, just like, you know, it's the same as drugs, marijuana, all of that. They say that's a crime. But if you go back to the era, what is it, before 1930 or 1915 or even further back, I'm not sure of the date, but I was just reading about that when you could go and buy a bottle of Coca-Cola and have real cocaine in it.
Yeah, you could buy heroin as a cough medicine.
You could go down to the counter drugstore and get those things over the counter
without
prescription.
Maybe that's it. We should prescribe heroin for the homeless. That could be the answer.
Well,
heroin and colostomy bags, both. That solves the problem of the toilet situation.
Prohibition of alcohol in the 20s didn't work.
It was done. A noble experiment, and now we're trying, even equally noble, prohibiting all other drugs. As you can see, it's a brilliant plan.
Criminalizing these things, I don't think, is the solution.
Thank you. Any final comments?
No. No.
How about cutting the city manager's salary back by half? There goes that mayor again.
He's not... If he sees me with you...
your history, man.
I'm on.
It's about 20 to 12, and I'm in the offices with...
Chris Congleton.
And...
Linda Esperanza.
And...
James Wittnick.
And...
Bernard Cliff.
It looks like three younger people, and you're all with which school?
Bayside Children's College.
And you just had an interview with the mayor?
Mm-hmm. Tim?
How'd that go?
That was good. He talked a lot about a lot of important issues, sleeping ban, rent control... some of the issues my students were involved in, like the skate park issue, and talked a lot about the political process and how he can't just do something that's ethical or, you know, maybe morally justified because he needs to do something that's politically successful, not necessarily right.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I got a good understanding of his position.
You're coming through. So you heard the mayor just ask us to, quote, take our meeting outside, not really where we're having a meeting.
No. From my perspective, some of my students were talking with a staff member.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting for them to finish up and talking with you.
Mm-hmm. The reason I'm asking these questions is that the mayor, the past mayor, has had me arrested at least twice at city council for, in essence, simply taking my time at the mic or just being an ordinary member of the audience, making a hand gesture indicating too much talk. So I'm a bit concerned that there be witnesses if the mayor decides he wants to close down public spaces. So that's why I'm asking you. And I'd like, has anyone here heard me raise my voice to the mayor or in any way create a disturbance?
No.
What's your name?
I'm Sean.
Have you heard me do any shouting or screaming in this office?
No.
Okay.
It's
about 20 to 12, actually a little bit before that, and the members of the Bayside School Community, what's it called? Bayside Children's College have taken off. Apparently their school is in India Joe's, And we were again told to, we were asked actually, we weren't told, but I don't know what kind of threats the mayor makes when he asks, to take our meeting outside when we were just having conversations in here. And I don't feel in a way that interfered with the staff or that disrupted the mayor. I mean, he had the open door to his office, and I was speaking about this tone of voice, perhaps, yeah, maybe a slightly louder.
Maybe a tiny bit louder. You know, I don't know why the mayor wants the public to leave the public office. He ought to be glad that people who are down here are being concerned. Not very many citizens even come.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that there may be the key that the mayor wants things to proceed without the public input that might make it a little messier, require a little more outreach, require a little more interaction with the public. And he particularly, you know, I think he also has a sensibility. He's a professor, you know, he's a school teacher, and he wants to kind of keep order in the classroom. But I think what he has to understand is that public spaces are not his classroom.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you know.
And that's more of the many, many hours in the City Council offices of Room 10. I guess that was almost 2 weeks ago. And as you can hear, we are screaming at the top of our voices, if you're to believe Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice and his perspective on what is going on in his offices. Well, we're almost at the end of Bathrobe Spears' Broadsides, and setting in for the little red hen is that rooster, Skidmark Bob, who's going to be... I got a crow, I'm just the cleverest fella 'twas ever my fortune to know. That sort of thing. We're going to be hearing a lot of that from Uncle Bob, one way or another. A couple of very quick things before I leave. Camp Dignity up in Portland, Oregon is in day 10 today. That is a tent city which the Portland, Oregon homeless, with a lot of supporters from the Howes community, are setting up downtown. After the September decision by Judge Gallagher overturning the entire camping ordinance, the police are still messing with homeless people. And in response, we're getting the Camp Dignity, which is really going further than saying not just overturn the camping ordinance, but let homeless people gather together and set up campgrounds where they can engage in some sort of, you know, emergency 24-hour activities, where they can go out and do work, come back, store their stuff, get protection from the elements and so forth, even if of a primitive nature. This is a story from the Portland, Oregonian. Cities still targeting homeless camps. 3 months ago, after a judge ruled Portland's anti-camping ordinance is unconstitutional, police are still working with outreach workers and using other ordinances to close down homeless camps. Let me give you the real English translation of that. They're still illegally giving tickets to homeless people and harassing them. That's from on-the-spot interviews with people in Portland, Oregon. Central Precinct officers have not arrested anyone for camping. That's not true, since an arrest means stopping someone and writing them a ticket. That is, in effect, an arrest. You cannot leave the scene when you're being written a ticket. You are under arrest. They are then releasing you in your own custody. That's what a ticket means. For camping since the September ruling, but ordinance opponents are frustrated by city attorneys' beliefs that the ordinance remains an available tool for breaking up camps. More than 20 local religious leaders delivered a letter to Mayor Vera Katz on Thursday in support of Judge Gallagher's ruling overturning the camping ban. They asked the mayor to budget more money for affordable housing and homeless assistance programs. If I was the mayor and the police chief was to come into my office, I would say, follow the law, said Chuck Curry, director of community outreach for First United Methodist Church. And the law says the anti-camping ordinance is unconstitutional. The city's 19-year-old anti-camping ordinance allows police to conduct sweeps and evict people from camps or other places where people sleep and keep belongings. It survived legal challenges until a father and son were cited in February while living in their pickup. In that case, Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Stephen L. Gallagher, Jr. ruled the anti-camping ordinance unconstitutional and punishes the status of being homeless. That ruling has been appealed to the State Court of Appeals, said Jim Van Dyke, a city attorney. He expects a decision by fall 2001. The judge's decision came in the context of a single criminal case in which two people were charged, Van Dyke said. The judge did not prohibit the city from ever using the ordinance again, and I think people don't understand that, and I understand why. It's confusing. Well, good. You can explain it to me, oh, city attorney. When the judge says that the law is unconstitutional, it means you don't use it again. What is your problem? Central Precinct Police also haven't arrested anyone for trespassing or sleeping in parks after hours since September, Sergeant Jim Powell said, and his nose got longer as he spoke. Instead, officers visit camps daily with staff members of JOIN, a nonprofit group that helps homeless people find housing. A camp sweep Monday beneath the Broadway Bridge found eight people in tents. They dubbed their home Camp Dignity, inspired by the Out of the Doorways campaign through the publication called Street Roots, a monthly nonprofit Portland newspaper for homeless and low-income people, said Brian Pollard, managing editor. The goal of the Out of the Doorways campaign is to move homeless people into sanitary, safe living environments with access to services, Pollard said. Camp Dignity mirrors this with its substance-free environment and communal living, he said. Police gave Camp Dignity a 24-hour eviction notice for trespassing, and the group moved under the Fremont Bridge on Tuesday. Powell visited them Friday, and police agreed to allow them to remain until December 26. The Dignity campers knew they would probably be moved by police and plan to move until they find a permanent site to promote their campaign, Pollard said. So far, police have been very accommodating. Powell said the campers are also willing to work with the police. They're being very responsive, and they're nice folks to work with, Powell said. It makes both fiscal sense and community sense not to arrest someone. Arrest in the long term won't impact camping. But affordable housing and assistance programs will affect homelessness, Curry said. We need to find permanent solutions, blah, 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 blah. So, all this is nice Christmas Eve feel-good talk from the Portland Oregonian. That's December 23rd, yesterday's paper. But the fact of the matter is, the police are still violating the law. Camping, though overturned by a duly constituted judge, is still being used to harass homeless people who have no other choice. That is the bottom line. And unfortunately, I'm at the bottom of my hour and the bottom of my time, and it's time for me to go bottoms up here. And move my... Yeah, right, you got it, man. And to move my bottom somewhere else, I suppose that's the deal. So I finally, with the assistance of Skidmark Bob, who's going to be giving us all the latest update on some ridiculous vanilla radio station 3,000 miles away, WBAI.
You're fired, buddy.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's going to tell us. They're firing all the residual, once we were radicals, now we're kind of half-assed radicals, but we just don't like it when the directors want to put our butts out on the street. We'll see, you know, how now they're getting some support, actually. WBAI, KPFA, all these Pacifica radio stations that are getting vanillized by the NPR gang, NPR-minded gang, are fighting back.
Don't forget about FCC trying to license low-power FM. All that's been killed, too.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Merry Christmas!
Oh. Well, we got Vinny's very pungent and elaborate analysis of that. He was pungent, all right. And he punged away. Unfortunately, I'd love to get he has such a great a summary of all that, which I'm still waiting to understand. And no, I really am. I mean, I understand some of it. I wish I could summarize it for you, and I wish I could see where the hell this song is so I can actually get it on here. I don't know which track is it on. I can't
look over here where it says tracks.
Oh, track. Oh, the number. Oh,
here on the back says land.
Oh, now we're talking. Track, man. You see, Bob here has done this before.
Close CD player.
And I push number 10. Yeah. I'm getting this step by step, folks.
It's on pause now.
Now we're pausing, and now I'm gonna.
All you have to do is hit that button, and it'll play.
You don't mean really hit it. You mean just sort of touch it, probably.
Yeah.
That's what he means. So I'm learning as we go. If I can learn, anybody can learn, folks. This should be a lesson for us all. And Uncle Bob here is going to be your instructor. Uncle Dennis. We won't talk about Uncle Dennis at this time. So let's see. This is.
You
want to
share a drink with me right now, Robert?
Cuervo. Hey, am I over 21? Yeah, I guess I won't be arrested for a curfew violation. Actually, I will actually have my first on-air drink. I'm rarely a drinking man, but since the Portland judge overturned the camping ban in September, this needs to be toasted, does it not?
Sure, you want Cuervo?
Just a little bit.
Okay.
Cheers. Whoa! Tastes just like turpentine. That's how I usually regard these alcoholic.
Hold your nose, it's amazing.
I don't usually engage in on-air alcoholic activities, folks. I want you to know that. I'm not that kind of broadcaster. Anyway, you've been listening to the free-living libertine Bathrobe Spear Robert Norris, already fumbling his words. And this show will return next, I guess it's Thursday.
Fired. You didn't get the courier, didn't make it to your house.
Good,
you've been fired,
good,
buddy.
Good point. My replacement for Bathroom Spears Broadsides will be happening from 6 to 8. Bob here, of course, is just kidding around.
No, actually, Amy Goodman will start to be doing your time slots.
Oh, excellent. Amy, she's actually a very, very well-known, well-spoken woman. We need somebody in there who's not the sexist dog that some of us are on the air, and I'd like to apologize again to all those broadcasters. But let's leave all this babble aside. See you tomorrow in front of the Vets Hall if you show up there and you're interested in organizing against those anti-homeless laws that I inveigh against so regularly, or Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock at City Hall. City Council Coffee Clatch with hot pastries, or let's put it this way, lukewarm pastries and hot coffee. What could you want for more? Want to join any of this protest activity or get some more information? 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And until then, you're on your own, and good luck.
The homeless, our problem, for only one reason. That president raises the question, who owns the land? The homeless, our problem, for only one reason. Our president raises the question, who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead Indians? Who owns the land? Could it be 6 million Jews? Who owns the land? Is there a connection? Who owns the land? To our imperialism? Who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me who owns the land? 'Cause I am just a white man. Who owns the land? I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to sleep. This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to be. Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be that there's a connection? Who owns the land? To my daily eviction. Who owns the land? And the extermination. Who owns the land of the Native American? Who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me who owns the land? 'Cause I am just a white man. Who owns the land? 'Cause I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Maybe it's me and you. Maybe it's not the corporations. Maybe the earth owns its own self. Maybe it's the Native American. The homeless are a problem for only one reason. My president raises a question, who owns the land? The homeless are a problem for only one reason. Your presence raises the question, who owns the land? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is
home?
Conclusion?
There is a certain social process which is known and very visible, but perhaps not acknowledged as much as it should be. It is that one where a new idea, or an old one in new form, is accepted.